Hello and welcome to Untalented by Unknown. We have started this podcast because we got sick of seeing gurus speaking to other gurus and ask for their guru-y advice. And it kind of made this wonderful creative industry even more inaccessible than it currently is. So this is Untalented by Unknown, a podcast where we speak to talented people that have come into this industry at varying levels. And today I am joined by employee number one at Unknown, Sam Winwood, and fan of John Bonham. And then a lady that is famous.
Best job in the world.
Exactly. A lady that is famous for making grannies knit wheat into balls and share that with milk and eat it. A lady that is famous for working for Simon Cowell. And a lady that currently resides as a group creative director at Vice Virtue, or Vice powered by Virtue, Carol Davids. Hello.
Hello.
Hello. I'm not going to ask you how you are because we agreed before we started this. You know those podcasts where there's a lot of small talk at the beginning. So I'm going to dive straight in and we're going to ask this of every single guest. You are our first guest. And this is the first time I've ever asked this question. Carol Davids. When was the first time you felt like you had talent and who told you that you did?
Okay, so before I answer that question, can I just say, I just need to swap around what you said.
Okay.
It's Virtue, powered by Vice.
Yeah.
Okay? So
wow.
I work for Virtue.
Yeah. Okay. Shall I go again?
No.
No, okay.
I just wanted to say that just to make sure.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Vice powered by Virtue. But maybe I'm giving Virtue more of a compliment there than Vice.
Maybe. Yeah,
you were probably. But yes, no, cool. So
the question
that you asked me was, when was the first time, was it that I felt that I could do it or was it that somebody inspired me? What were you?
Yeah, I think I want to know, like, you're a young girl and you've got no idea what you're going to do next. And someone says, hey, that thing you just did, you've got talent. Do you remember when that was?
Yeah, I think I was always really good at art. Found that quite easy, to be honest.
Okay.
Didn't really rate it because I found it quite easy.
Right.
So it was one of those things that people used to sort of tease me about at school all the time. And they always used to say, oh, Carol's going to be an artist when she grows up. Oh, she's an artist. And I generally did most people's drawings for them, always. But it didn't make me think this is the thing because it was quite easy. And I always had that feeling that, you know, things should be a lot harder. And then I think when I sort of was looking at options and things like that of what to do, medicine would have been my first thing, to be fair.
Okay.
I would have probably wanted to go to medicine, but it felt easier because the way I had to do my schooling was I kind of left school at 16 and then had to kind of go straight to a sort of like tech college to do my A-levels.
Yeah.
Because of where I'd come from. I didn't really have that access to be able to kind of do it at school. So I kind of then had to make a decision quite quickly, quite early on at about 16. And they sort of pushed me from where I was coming at into the arts, really, if you like. And then I went to sort of college, first of all, and thought I might do fine art. But obviously,
okay.
I suppose selfishly, I just thought, I'm not sure if there's much money there.
Yeah.
It'll take a long time.
Like one painting
a
year.
To buy the things I want.
Yeah.
You know, so, and then I sort of went to college and then sort of went on to Salford to do the advertising course there. But I didn't think of myself as, I was still doing okay. And I guess because I thought, you know what, I can do art, it's not really a problem. I didn't really find it very hard. And it wasn't like, I wasn't really in the industry then. And I think what then happened was when I finished my my course there and I got my degree and everything else, we then, people were then sort of going off on their sort of gap years and things like that. And I wasn't in that situation where I could afford to do that, to be honest. And so I just kind of took myself off one day and just said to this agency that happened to have a very nice swimming pool, can I work for you? I'll work for you for nothing, please.
Okay.
And they said, yeah.
How did you...
In Manchester?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Cheshire, actually, they like to say. But it's
Right. That's the posh Manchester. So, okay, so how did you find out at that point that even an agency existed? Because you've gone from being like, I might do art, to then, you know, what is advertising?
Well, we all knew which agencies were what when we were doing our advertising course. But also when I then went to McCann at the time, which is the agency I'm talking about, and worked there, what your question was, which I didn't really answer, was that you said to me, you know, when did you think you might be talented or you might be good at what you did? Was that there was a guy called Alan Dickman, who ran at the time BDH in Manchester, and that was actually quite a cool agency at the time. And he had sort of seen me and was kind of like watching me almost, but the reason he was watching me was there was a really cool girl called Jo Hodges at the time, who had done some really brilliant stuff and come down to London. And actually did make a name for herself and was amazing. Lots of people, I think, like even like Dave Bonaguidi always talks about her. She's brilliant.
Wow,
brilliant.
Okay.
And she was the first person of colour that I ever saw working in this industry. Sadly, she's passed away now. But I kind of did have an eye on her and thought, oh, you know, I'll think I'm actually quite good. Or does he think I'm good, or does he think I'm another Joe? And there was that sort of like, I was slightly fearful of that, but he did make me think, actually, you know, somebody wants my talent, really. Yeah. Whereas I'd kind of come from that thing of like, well, where, you know, who's going to take me rather than, you know, and trying to offer my services free rather than the fact that somebody actually thought I had talent, as it were, really.
And we're in the 80s or 90s right now?
I'm not even going to answer that.
But I'm trying to paint the picture in my head, right? So we've got...
I think we're in the 90s.
We're in the early 90s. Yeah. And I know this time in advertising, it wasn't exactly littered with people of colour, let alone female leaders. Was it Joe Hodges? How many people like that existed? And did you feel like, because there were maybe fewer of them around, did you feel like, well, I'm nothing like her, or there are parts of me that aren't like her, so therefore I can't become like her? Or did you feel quite confident?
I probably have to be a bit personal here and say that actually I haven't come from that background. I grew up in Care where, I mean, it was really diverse there, really, to be honest. Everybody was from everywhere, black, white, yellow, everybody. You had everybody there, and I didn't ever think about me not being accepted. And if I wasn't accepted, I just sort of took it on the chin,
right?
To be honest, I didn't really have that worry,
yeah,
as it were. And I knew that when I went to McCann's, it would be a thing, because I'm in the middle of Cheshire,
right?
You know, and there's a really funny story of the first time I got there. It was still very advertising-y then, and at that time, I remember a group of them. And the people that might listen to this might remember who they were. And they would sort of work in the mornings and then just go out in the afternoons, really.
Yeah.
And what they'd say is things like, they'd say things like, oh, we're going to go to the said pub in Prestbury, and we're going to have mulled wine. But at the time, I'm a kid from a kid's home who's just suddenly joined, you know, finished my studies, and now I'm sort of in this really posh place in Prestbury, and I'm there thinking to myself, did she say mulled wine? Mulled wine? And so for me, I was really kind of like, I was still like, I literally didn't know what anybody was talking about.
Right.
All the time, really, because they were all sort of off buying, like, they would, at lunchtimes, they would go off and buy, like, antiques and things like that in their lunchtime, come back with these things wrapped in newspaper that were worth thousands.
Are you sure you're in Manchester?
And I was in, like, yeah, I was in agency, because they were all into buying nice objects, because obviously they're creatives, but they're into buying sort of, like,
right, okay.
And that's what it was then, and I was still trying at that time to get to McCann's at the time in Prestbury and jump on the train without paying.
Right.
So
okay.
I was still that person. Yeah. So there was a massive gap, really, between us then, and it was really quite interesting, because I remember when they finally said to me, you know, I went in and saw the boss there and said to him, I'm going to have to leave because they've sort of caught me sort of jumping on the train, and I literally can't really afford to keep working here. And they'd forgotten that I wasn't being paid.
Wow.
No.
So they just said, oh my God, we're not paying Carol. Oh, we're not paying? Oh, we better take her on. So they just took me on, and then they just sort of wrote up a contract and kind of filled this money in. And I remember at the time it was really low, but the guy that was sort of filling in the money sort of forgot how much he'd said. And I had to remind him and say, no, you said it was going to be a bit more. Oh, did I? And just changed it.
Wow.
So it was really that kind of like, it was the end of that era, if you like.
Yeah, sort of fag packet projections.
It was that, really. And I was kind of like starting out, really. But it was still a very, you know, an interesting time for me to start there. And then, you know, sort of quite quickly after that, I went from, you know, I must have been the only person, I think, that went from working sort of like as a junior.
Yeah.
And it quite quickly, I must have like, I can't even say, I mean, without having to actually say the money, I probably earned 10 times the money within like the next 2 years.
Wow.
My wages just went straight up.
So it was an industry where you, if you made it, you were quickly then paid.
Yeah, you were quickly then paid, and actually it was a and given and at that time given a car.
Jesus Christ. That's handy.
So I was also given a car and everything else, and did quite well there, but was still, you know, this guy Al Dickman still had his sights on me, and I was still used to think, oh God, can I do it? So I sort of didn't really have the confidence. Okay. And I did have a chat with him, and he did keep saying to me, you need to come here. I need to help you get to where you need to be. You know, and I still sort of, you know, think, gosh, what would my life have been like now if I'd gone and joined, you know, and joined there? Because it was, at the time, it was seen to be a bit of a lads agency.
Right.
Very cool lads agency. Yeah. And McCann was very much more sort of like a bit corporate at the time then, really. Yeah, so, yeah, that was kind of like my start.
What did a typical day-to-day look like for a placement or an intern back in the 90s for you?
I think you basically were sort of, I hate to say this, but you were sort of like, you know, making the drinks and definitely on drinks duty, definitely kind of putting all the work on boards, definitely nostril full of spray mount, I'm afraid. Not because I'd put it there, but because you were generally putting all the work together.
Right.
Yeah. And that was the only stress you ever had, was like putting the work on boards as fast as possible, visualising everything up, doing all the drawings and stuff.
Did you get any opportunities to add your own ideas into the mix? Or?
Yeah, as soon as that did happen, then you were kind of like off that, really, to be honest. And like, you know, wasn't that long. And I got a partner who had worked in London at the time as well, and worked with her, and sort of that gave us a little bit of credibility. We're both called Carol, and obviously as a team it was quite a good thing to be, so we kind of like, you know, rose from then.
Nice.
So okay, the journey then goes, I'll kind of move through it because I know relatively well, but we went from there, ended up in London, Knitting Grannies, famous work for Shreddies, Psycho, which was, I want to hear a little bit about Psycho. Yeah, what was that like working for Simon Cowell? Was it directly for Simon Cowell?
It was directly for, actually, Nigel Hall.
Oh, yeah.
Who then actually is obviously Simon's right-hand man. But I think I was just very lucky at the time that they were looking for somebody who kind of understood mass market brands. And at the time, I was actually at Leo's.
Okay.
And I really like mass market brands. I actually quite like the challenge of working with real people. I just quite like that. I'm not a, you know, and he saw, I think, a comparison to, well, he actually saw the similarities between the audiences that I was working with, whether that be on serials, if you like, and FMCG, and the audiences that he was trying to pull in. And so
things like Pop Idol or X Factor.
Yeah, all of those, the same audience, aren't they?
Yeah. Really?
And what is it, you know, how could he look at his brands and maybe, you know, split them up? Because actually I think X Factor at the time and Britain's Got Talent were sort of almost feeling a little bit similar.
Yeah.
And so Nigel, you know, who is an incredibly creative guy, just decided that he just thought, what if, why don't we try? Why don't we just give it a go? You know, why don't we just ask Carol if she wants to come on board and help us work on this stuff? So I did that for a year, and I can say it was really good fun, but it just wasn't advertising.
No,
in what way?
The same. I think you need to be in that business quite young.
Yeah.
And I felt a bit bad that I was kind of like this kind of quite seasoned person, but actually I didn't know enough about that industry to kind of just take a risk, if you like. I didn't know those things. Mm. There were certain things that I think junior people knew more than I did, which wasn't really about my ego, but I just didn't feel like I was as confident to be able to go on and do all that. I enjoyed it, and I think I did learn a lot in the year that I was there, you know, and I have a lot more respect than I did, you know, before that kind of industry. But I missed advertising. I missed all the insights and stuff like that, really, and the kind of the making of stuff and building a brand with a client, and I really missed all that.
Okay. And now, okay, so now you're a group creative director at Virtue Vice. Two questions. Number one is how would you describe that role to a child or to your mother downstairs? And the second question I want to know is a bit deeper, which is what's changed in Adland since 90s Carol running around and now Vice Virtue? So yeah, we'll start with the first question. How would you describe that role?
The role at Vice, I would say, first of all, I'd probably say let's forget the titles, really. I think the titles are given, but obviously all that kind of meant to me. And I think at the time, the guy that kind of like really inspired me to want to go there was Morten Grubeck, who is like, you know, like a god, basically. Mm. He's amazing.
Who is he?
Morten is the ECD, who at the time was kind of like covering the whole of Europe. He sits in Copenhagen. And what was really interesting was that their model at the time was that actually the agency was borderless. So actually you were working this huge agency right across the world, but you really were, you know, like some agencies say, oh yeah, yeah, we've got an office here, an office there, but we really were, you know, and I loved that idea. I loved the fact that as soon as I got there, I was working on, at the time I was working on sex toys and Coke, right. Coca-Cola, great, you know, but I was working in America. I was working in Singapore and in Dubai. Wow. So all the people that I was working with were from all over the world. And I just loved the excitement of being able to kind of get on a Zoom and then just, you know, a group of people and then just work with them like that. And I think the diversity of thought of how all those people come together just makes for really great creative and really good thinking. And it really excited me. And I just thought this is a really interesting way of working. And it wasn't that we were just kind of like working remote. It was the fact of all those people coming together. I think I really sort of that's the bit that I really loved. Really,
does that go wrong? So where does that? It sounds nice for the idea of, I guess diversity of thought and collaboration. Where does that go wrong? Do you think the borderless part, you know, creativity part?
I don't know if it goes wrong as such. I think what you're trying to say to me is that are you talking about, you know, do you need a team? Do you need to be in an office with other people to kind of feed off them? Then I think yes, but we could still be in an office in London, and we still are in an office in London feeding off people, but we're also talking to people in other countries who are probably or sometimes more right for the thing that we want to solve, who probably have another version of what we could be doing to solve a problem, if you know what I mean. We just have that, really, which I think is really cool. But also there's a thing at Virtue, I think, that is really true, which is that a lot of the people there, because it comes from Vice, are definitely in culture themselves.
Yeah.
So that the stuff that they bring to the party does come from culture. They naturally do it. It isn't like we have to go and go, oh, I'm gonna have to go and find some, you know, some teenagers from East London or something. They actually know. And I think that's really cool. And for me, as much as I am classed as a group creative director, I learn from them as well. And actually what we see is that I suppose there's always change happening. And I guess, you know, the way that you were going to give me the next question, the way that Adland has changed. And you know, obviously all it is that the media spaces have changed, haven't they?
Yeah.
We're now in the metaverse.
Are we? You know?
Jesus. Well, we are, aren't we? But, you know, and I just think it's just a different space, isn't it, to play? And for me, I'm quite excited by that because I have still got the energy for the business, if you like. I like that. I like the fact that things change. It's not going to be the same, you know, and it's never going to be the same, is it? It's always going to keep moving. And I think that is probably what might have saved me in my years, is that I'm keen to carry on moving.
I was going to ask, actually, what is there anything more that's kept you energized over the years to continue to service Adland?
I think different kind of business and learning something new. And I obviously, the way that we work at Virtue is totally different than the way, you know, I worked at McCann, although I'm really grateful to McCann. And also very different to the way that I worked at Leo Burnett.
What about attitudes, right? So there's, you know, I think, well, I wasn't around in Adland in 1990, but you watch the Mad Men things and you see these kind of like egotistical dudes, and it was about the beer ad, and the beer ad would be the thing that went like viral. I don't know, from what I can see now, it feels like you're seeing that, but on a different kind of scale. Is there anything else that's kind of just never going to be the same compared to 1990 Adland that you see?
I don't think we're ever going to sort of, I don't think there's going to be any ever room for sexism, is there? I don't think there is in ads. I don't think we're going to see that. I just don't think, I think there's too many me's.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? I think, you know, we wouldn't see that. And if it did, I think we would definitely see it pulled down. Yeah. I think people are on it, aren't they? And I think, you know, Gen Z are just not about to put up with it either.
No.
They're not going to put up with that. I think, you know, where you can as well, when you're talking to young creators who are coming in, they want to do stuff that's purpose driven.
Yeah. What does that mean?
What does that mean? And people go, oh no, are we going to sell our product? Or, well, you know, it's not just about doing that, is it? you've got to find a purpose, haven't you, within your product, really? There's got to be a purpose, hasn't there, really? I think, and I think it goes back to something that actually I probably learned in Psycho as well, which is that, you know, whenever they're making like films and, you know, programs and stuff, it's like, make me care. You know, who cares? You know, it's like, if I'm, if you've got to try and find something in there that makes me care about it. And I think when creatives do stuff that they really care about, it really shows.
Yeah.
You know, we just won most of the awards. I think Morton just won, I should say. Morton's team just won for Backup Ukraine, which some people might go, oh, awards, awards. But actually, it's a really good cause. And I think, you know, the reason why the work looks the way it looks and the reason why the team fought so hard is because they cared about the work and kind of turned, you know, made, you know, gave the, used tech in the best way possible, you know, to be purpose-driven.
What if they don't care? Because that is the brief now, right? Everyone was saying that this year's Cannes, it's, they've been saying it for the last three Cannes, right? It's all about purpose porn and all that shit. What if you do get the purpose porny brief and it's from, I don't know, Shreddies, and they're like, we've got to do something about sustainability. Go. How do you, how much do you feel like a fraud and then actually someone that is making something that could be purposeful in the right way?
I think if a client actually asks you to do something you don't agree with, you can't go there, can you? You've just got to say to them, you've got to tell them why you're not going there. And I think they'll, if they're any good themselves, they'll respect you for saying that isn't the right thing to do.
Yeah,
we don't believe it's the right. And we have turned down clients and we've said to clients, you know, I think this is the wrong agency. This isn't what we do and we can't do it for you. And creators will, creatives definitely will say that they won't work on stuff. I mean, years ago, it used to be that creatives would say that they wouldn't work on cigarettes. You know, well, I imagine there'll be creatives that come through that won't work on a lot of things. And I think, again, it's up to us to kind of work on, work with clients to work out those briefs to help them run their businesses. And, you know, they are being challenged at the moment.
Okay. I asked that just because we, that seems to be the biggest complaint that creative recruiters are getting now, is like, I don't want to work on bullshit purpose stuff. I want to work on, if it really should exist within that brand, then I'll make a sustainable campaign that's centered around environmental whatever. What I don't want to have to do is make a mental health campaign for a bank that basically puts people into debt and they're saying we're here, because that doesn't feel real or authentic. But they pay the bills and they had the budgets. And I think what's happening now is it's not as clean cut as Shell asking you to do an environmental campaign. It is a bank going, we care about pride now. Yeah, because it's Pride this week. So can you do a pride thing? And it's got to be more than just the multicolored flag. Like, make our bank the Pride Bank. I think a creative would find it hard to not say, okay, because they haven't really got grounds to say that that bank isn't a pride bank.
But I think you're also working with the audience. Let's not forget the audience as well.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of the time now in advertising, we're working with the audience. The audience are, you know, if you think about it, the audience are running it in some cases. And I think, you know, the audience will tell you. They won't allow it anyway, will they? You know, if they don't agree with it either. So I think that's one of the things. I worked for a small agency for a while called The Elephant Room. And I think the thing that I liked about there was how they kind of, it was a very lean team. But what they do, and I think they do really well, is that they bring in the audience to work on the ideas with them.
How do they do that?
That's interesting.
How does that work? What, is it they bring in like...
Yeah. So basically, like it, I suppose it's like, but more like a freelance team, wouldn't it? So basically what you do is you work with the audience to come up with the idea and pay them, obviously. But I mean, what you're doing then is you're kind of working with the people that you're talking to, aren't you? So you get a more true version of what they really want to see.
Is that rather than working with Insights, or would you still work with Insights as well?
You'd work with Insights. Like at the time when I worked there, it was a really cool, very good... planner, strategy guy, Insights guy, I suppose, because he had to do quite a lot of work, called Will O'Shea, Will Groot. I called him Will O'Shea, I don't know. That's my old partner's name, I'm so sorry. Will de Groot, he's called, and he's really good. Yeah, I mean, I think he's moved on to Lego now, but he was very good at sort of getting young people in and finding, really sort of mining those insights, and then also, you know, trying to work on creative ideas with them and with us. I think that was a really nice way to work, but also a really nice way to sort of give back to the community.
What's that them. For sure? I'm just quite curious. Do you know of any other places working like that at the moment? Why don't more agencies work like that?
I don't know, but I can. You can.
We'll go find some.
Have you tried to implement that into Vice or Virtue? Sorry.
I think the thing is, I think the people, the creators that we have in Virtue are those people.
Right.
They all come from different backgrounds. They don't come just from straightforward advertising backgrounds. They're not come from straightforward ad schools. And also, there's a different flavour, isn't there, that you'll get from, say, like Singapore, than you will get from, say, like Copenhagen, where they're all like super talented.
Designy, very designy,
but
people.
Very creative,
and super lovely.
I want to just quickly flip back to insight-driven work, because you made grannies knit wheat for Shreddies. What was the insight there? How does that happen?
So first off, it makes me sound like some really mean person. Making their grannies knit.
Yeah, at gunpoint, they're
really,
just knitting
again.
Away.
It was a really very good. Strategy person, planner, I would call them, I suppose. Nikki, who was really excellent, and she'd given us a really great brief, and I think her strategy was engineered to be delicious. And at the time, the brand was really suffering. The brand, and I don't know, I'm just going to say it.
Yeah,
the brand was almost going to be delisted at the time, and had a really good client, Phil Toms, who really wanted to kind of do something different. And the brief was good. He said, right, come to the factory and see the stuff being made. And we all sort of trolled off, got to the factory. I had to wear about 5 hairnets just to put this in, which was quite strange, and plodded around this factory somewhere outside Liverpool. And there was this huge building and just this one man pressing a button. And I thought, what's he doing? Well, he pressed this button and suddenly this huge knitting machine started off. And it was literally just like wheat being sort of like almost like knitted and sort of like cut into these little tiny pillows, then it would go into like this oven, then the pillows would rise, and then it just all be shipped into this big drum. So it literally was there.
Wow.
It was there for us, wasn't it? But we just wanted to humanize the brand. So how do we do that? How do we humanize the brand? How do we make something that sounds and feels as if it's going to be delicious, that would be a gift to give to anybody? And so Knitting Nanas was born. And it was actually more about the fact that if you look at a Shreddy, to me, I in my mind at the time, after quite a lot of coffee, thought that it looked very much like a little knitted square.
Yeah.
You know, I worked with a really good writer at the time as well, who was John Hurst, who isn't just a writer, I suppose he's like a god of creativity as well, from America. And him and myself, we sat there and we kind of wrote these scripts, and then went off to Poland and found a really quite disgusting looking, what do you call them where they kill animals?
Hunter.
Pardon?
Abattoir?
Like. An abattoir. An empty abattoir.
What? Filled an it abattoir?
Full of, yeah, filled it full of grannies and shot it. And then the first one was born. But it was quite a funny little thing, but it kind of really did take that brand off, you know, and put it back on the shelf for them.
Why an abattoir? Really, I was really confused, sorry.
We needed a big space.
Right.
And at the time in Poland, they were looking around for this big factory that we could use. And there was an empty abattoir at the time. And I thought, oh, how ironic. But anyway, we got there and went to Poland and we filled it full of these nanas, full of old people. And then just kind of like put the front row of English nanas at the front. And
the Polish nans at the back.
The Polish nanas were at the back. And they were very annoyed because our English nanas had a way of knitting that they didn't knit.
Oh, wow.
So we had to
knitting
teach
politics.
All of them.
Knitting politics.
Knitting politics did take place, but yeah.
But okay, and we were all sitting in this room, we remember the ad.
Yeah.
I can't tell you any ad that's on TV now that I remember. I'm not going to do that old, back in the old days it was easier or people watch more TV. What is the version of knitting nannies now? What have you seen that's kind of humorous and that you would recognise as a brand? It hasn't got to be an ad, it could be a TikTok movement or an art installation, whatever. Have you seen like something that made you go, oh, okay, that's changed my perception of that brand, or I feel a lot, that has made me feel something today? And you can say no if you want.
I'm inspired by lots of things, I guess. So I'm thinking, I mean, it's whether the question is, would something make me change my mind? Would it shift my perception?
Yeah.
Or has it? Yeah, or has it? I guess I might kind of say, and it is only because it's something I've sort of pulled through. I mean, obviously we've just had cancer. I've seen lots of work that I think is really interesting. But I suppose, like, yeah, I kind of, I suppose I did, I should say, work of our own, but I won't. So I won't be sort of...
You can. Statistical.
Yeah. No, I won't do that. I don't think that's the right thing to do. But I think, yeah, I would say I did see the posters that Niels did for the dog insurance.
Yeah.
And it would make me kind of think, oh, do I want one of those?
A dog? Yeah. Or the,
yes, I do want a dog. I would like a dog.
Since seeing the ad, you've gone, I want a dog now.
Yeah, but do I want a dog or do I want, what would they call it? I mean, there were a couple of lines in there that I thought were, there was like a stress ball.
Can you explain the work? What was the work, just for anyone that hasn't seen it?
Well, the work was a series of shots of animals. And I think what I quite liked was they were explaining the relationship that one has with an animal. It's not just about a pet, is it? Like sometimes your pet's there, but actually, you know, stroking a cat is a stress ball.
Yeah.
And I thought that was quite an interesting take on it. I did think it was a really kind of a nice thought. And I thought, yeah, actually, they do mean a lot to us. They're not just pets, are they? And they're even better than family members, aren't they, really, yeah. In some ways.
They don't really complain.
No, well, I think they can do.
Yeah, if you get a yappy one, they can be quite annoying.
Mine wouldn't, obviously.
No, of course. Yours would just have a muzzle.
That would be great, yeah. So, yeah. And a lot of people in our office and our offices, I should say, have pets.
Yeah.
We even have a channel that is just about pets.
But it's quite, that's mental, by the way. It's quite, that ad is really simplistic, right? It's just a photo of a dog and it's got dopamine written on the across its forehead, right? Or it's a cat and it's got stress ball written across its body. Yeah. Is it just because that is beautifully simplistic that we recognise it? Or is it because it's done by Uncommon that we've looked at it? If you saw that walking around the street, would you look at it and go, wow?
I don't know if I'd go, wow. I might think about it. What I thought was interesting wasn't necessarily, I mean, I think it was reasonably art direction and everything else, but what I thought was just a take on pets was quite interesting. Mm. I thought it was a truth. And I thought also, especially after COVID, it's been a big thing, hasn't it?
Yeah.
I don't know if anybody's just seen the fact that, you know, they've got all those beagles in America that they've just rescued about 1,000 beagles because they were all sort of like used for drug testing and things like that. People do care about animals. And I think it goes back to what we talked about earlier, is that, do I care?
Mm.
If I care about animals, then maybe I'm going to look at that poster.
Yeah.
If I don't, then I won't, will I?
It's not for you, move on.
Yeah. I also care a lot about cars.
You do?
Yeah. So I'd probably look at a car.
Really?
Yeah, I do.
So, okay, I want to ask about car ad, and I'm going to pan over to Ian in a second. I have never cared about a car ad. Have you ever seen a car ad that you've gone for?
Cloaks by Adam and Eve was amazing. The one where they had the cloaks over the all types of electric cars.
Okay.
Not just Volkswagen. Have you seen that one?
What
about the one for Lexus, and it was the kind of and Honda Illusions?
I think you've just topped into something quite dangerous.
Oh, really?
Well, I think,
Honda,
you know,
hands. Honda.
Well, okay.
BMW
Honda ads.
Some of the best work in the world. Huh? BMW's probably done some of the best work in the world.
Yeah.
But I don't go, I want to buy a Beetle. I don't look at it and go...
You don't care about cars, mate.
No. Not
a
Volkswagen.
That's just a weakness of mine, by the way. It's just a real bad weakness.
Really?
Yeah.
Can you tell me about a time that you saw an ad and bought a car?
No.
I couldn't afford the car I would want to, you know, the ad that I might have seen and thought, oh, wow.
Okay, but it's given you a feeling of desire. So which ad was that?
Do you know what? It would be, I suppose, I mean, years ago would have been some of the Sean Dawes stuff that he did, where it'd just be like, you know, like the little scratches in the road where another car has actually stopped to look at the car.
Okay.
You know, things like that, it would have been. I shouldn't talk about it because it's so bad, isn't it? Sustainability.
Yeah.
I'm sort of in that space now at the moment where you've got to try and get yourself an electric car.
Yeah. How are you feeling about that?
Oh, should I hold on? Maybe next year.
Until a cool one comes out.
Well, no, there's some cool ones coming out, aren't there?
Because I feel some level of responsibility as a recruiter to be doing a bit more, but I'm curious to see from your point of view, like, if there's... Are we missing something?
Can I call out elephant in room? I think actually this might be easier because I just want to say what we experience as creative recruiters.
Okay.
And that is that we will get a brief from a big agency saying, I want to hire a black female creative director. And when we get briefed like that, it's...
You say they're going to be really expensive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're going to be a double whatever you're looking to pay.
And cars and Lambos.
Yeah, he wants a free car for sure.
Growing a pet.
But how does that make you feel? Like, I know how that makes us feel, but when you hear that kind of thing, how does that make you feel?
That's a bit crap, isn't it? Let's face it. It's not great, is it? And I just think, you just want to be liked for the work you do, don't you? You don't want to be liked for what you look like.
Yeah.
It needs to be about the work. I never forget when I was a young planner there saying to me, why do we even need to have pictures on LinkedIn? He said, because when I was looking at agencies, you know, I kind of thought, oh gosh, you know, are all the people going to be white? Do I need to check to see if some people are black? Who's doing what, whatever? And he said, and actually I just thought, do we need to have them at all? You know, and I think that's a really big thing. And I think it's just, I understand what's going on in the industry and that we do need to make sure that everybody's included. Mm. But actually to say that, to actually kind of call it out like that is just not, it's just not right, is it?
No. How, and then
it's always got to be about the work. It's got to be talent, hasn't it?
Yeah. Playing devil's advocate then, and saying that, you know, I need to see it to be it kind of thing. What do you do? So in their shoes, how do they hire more female black leaders that they don't currently have without explicitly saying it? Because then we're in a bit of a catch-22.
I think what they need to do is they just need to make sure that their agency has got a D&I policy.
Yeah.
So that when you put it in, you say that, obviously, we just need a really good creative director.
Yeah.
And it shouldn't matter whether it's female, male, or what colour.
Yeah.
Or neurodiverse or whatever, should it really? You just need to say what the job is, but also make sure, and this is our policy.
Yeah.
This is what we believe in. This is the kind of shit we run. And yeah. I think that's all you need to say, isn't it, really? I mean, I don't feel the need in Virtue to even really talk about D&I because it's kind of there.
Why is that, though? Because that wasn't the case in 1990.
Of Virtue. Yeah. I don't really know what Virtue was like then. But I guess it was more vicey. Mm. I don't know why. I think the thing is I also think that even from the community itself, I don't think that my community realised that there were jobs that were out there that they could do within the industry either. I don't think that they were saying things. And also I blame myself. I was very quiet in the industry when I came in. And also I think, like, you know, I can talk to my resource director at the moment, Paul Bell. He would say the same. I mean, we're probably a similar age and we've been in the business a long time. Mm. And I don't think we felt that we needed to tell people what we were doing. And we probably should really have called it out and said, hey, we're doing this, and brought people in more. So it's as much about, you know, what we've done as well. I kind of, if you like, in my first sort of, I would say 5 or 6 years of advertising, I basically just kind of put my head down and thought, God, thank God I've got this job, and just make sure no one finds out that I'm here, you know. And yeah, it was tough. There were some tough times in those first years that I didn't think of. I didn't bother complaining because I didn't want to, you know, rock the boat.
Yeah.
But, you know, I remember my first time when I was in Manchester working and I came down to London, and there used to be a big thing about being able to catch a train down to London, stay in a hotel, blah, blah, do the work. And that was the one perk from working in Manchester,
right,
is that when you worked, when you had shoots on, you came down to London. And I remember a guy saying, what, she needs a first class ticket, her? And he was really kind of like, you know, he couldn't believe that I should be getting a first class ticket.
Wow.
Because he just couldn't, and it was just fine for him to say that. Because it was that time of year when, you know, people did speak like that.
Yeah.
They did have a problem. You know, I've had clients who've kind of looked at a storyboard and thought that somebody on the storyboard might look like they might be black, and has said, oh no, you know, we don't want, you know, that person looks too exotic.
Too exotic?
Yeah.
How long ago was that?
Well, I suppose that could have been about 10 years ago. Right. But I have still had that awkward conversation maybe 3-4 years ago as well.
God. Because I remember us talking about casting as well, and getting your casting right, and how important that is, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and I think, and I seem to be sort of plugging everybody in the industry don't I, at the moment, but yeah, it is true. Alex from We Are Pie did a really cool thing, which was called Don't Shoot, which was just his take on on this whole thing of being sort of inclusive is that actually the biggest area that we find this happening is when we're casting in this industry is when clients are casting, the thing that they put forward is shocking. So his thing called Don't Shoot, have a look at it. I'm sure you can download and send it to you if you want. But it's really important, you know, how we kind of like cast people for jobs and the language that we use as well.
Mm. I just going back to the diversity and inclusion policy part as well, because we see a lot of agencies and brands have those policies in place, but there seems to be an issue around the structure, or at least the cultural structure within an agency, which kind of has a negative impact on the inclusive element of it. Does that make sense? So you can have a diversity policy, but I feel like not many people really know how to be inclusive, you know, because you know, people from minorities come into an advertising agency and they feel automatically excluded because they're the only ones there. They don't. So I had a really compelling conversation with a young black creative who was born and bred in Brixton, mm-hmm. around multiple different multiple cultures and whatnot, and super talented guy. He worked at a massive agency in London. He was the only black guy in a 60-person agency.
Yeah.
Everybody went to the pub at lunchtime. Mm. He was like, where he came from, nobody went to the pub. Mm. He was just playing in a park, or they'd go and shoot something, or they'd go to an art gallery or something like that. Yeah. So he ended up just going to an art gallery at lunchtime. And he was like, and it got me thinking, it really made me think, like, that's a really good point. It's like, white middle-class people go to the pub.
Not everybody. Culturally, we don't do what we used to do.
Yeah,
culturally, it isn't at the pub, and they did go to the pub years
ago. Yeah, yeah. And I think that, mostly. And I'm not saying that's the only thing that needs to change. By the way, I'm just saying that as one example of a really made me think, like, structurally, they're not set up in the right way. So, advertising agency can say they've got a diversity and inclusion policy. How they use it is a different matter.
Yeah.
And I feel some sort of, you know, being someone who connects these dots and people with the agency, I feel like I should be saying more, but I'm kind of at a loose end because we're kind of.
You're finding the talent. You're not in charge. Of kind of like.
But I think it's also about. I mean, for me, I've been a creative director for quite a long time now, and I've obviously hired people, and I always have this thing where I kind of, when I'm hiring people, when I'm talking to them, I always ask them how they like to be managed.
Yeah.
And then I tell them how I also like to manage, and I guess I treat all the stuff that I work with, and especially the stuff that are kind of under my, you know, my sort of, I suppose. My sort of instruction that I just sort of say to them, you know, I have a more of a one-to-one relationship with them where I they tell me how they like to work and what they like to work on, and I probably understand culturally more about where they're coming from, and I think you kind of have to do that. I don't think it's a case of you're not sort of creating these sort of, you know, these juniors that then become teams that then become almost like carbon copies of each other within an agency like we used to.
I think it's just laziness. Like, I believe it's managerial and business laziness. Yes, there is intersectionality, and that's a really important thing to understand. But what we're really saying is get to know the human being.
Yeah.
Because everyone is going to be very different, whether they're whatever ethnicity or whatever religion or whatever hobby they have. You just need to get to understand that individual person.
Yeah.
It's when you blanket people with different terms or like cultures. Also, I think a lot of people, when they arrive in a business culture that has a certain way, they probably want to just feel included and listened to. It's not necessarily they want something that needs to be like a thing built around that one person that's, you know, because I think that's exclusive. If someone says, well, where's the gay, Jewish, whatever, and you build all the intersections, where's that, you know, policy or party? I don't think that's what people that live in a different minority are asking for. They're just asking to feel listened to and included. And I think that's where a lot of us get.
It can backfire and make you feel like a bit of a loser, I'm afraid.
Yeah.
It can make you feel like that, because it can make you feel like, oh, we're only here for this. But, you know, I do think the industry is changing. And I know that sounds really rich coming from me, but I went on a shoot recently with a client. And again, obviously the American clients, all the clients were black,
obviously I'm black, and I think also the producer was black as well. And we all sat around, and there was just one point where we all looked and thought, hey, things have really changed, haven't they, here? And they had, and it was really interesting, and for me, I kind of thought, I don't want it to go all the way. I want it to be everybody. I don't want it to be, because I'm still of that, you know, I was brought up in that way of, you know, where I come from. There was lots of people. It was never just one person. It was never just all blacks, all whites or whatever. And even Asian people as well. So it wasn't like that. It was, you know, we were always very inclusive. So I think things are changing. But I do think there are other communities that are also thinking, it's about time that we were listened to as well.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, the black community have done a lot of work, and, you know, we're still not finished, but I think there are other communities as well that we also need to start listening to.
Which ones?
A lot more. Well, for example, one of the girls that I work with, Creative, she does a lot around Asian hate. And I said to her, it can't just be Asian hate, it needs to be a bit broader than that, because, you know, it is much more than that, isn't it? So we run a thing at work where we have a culture share every sort of 2 weeks or whatever, and all creative, everybody in the agency gets to kind of share a little bit of culture that they want to talk about or something they care about.
Love that.
And what's really nice is that everybody gets to know a little bit more about each other. And it works. It seems to be working really well for us. So.
That's nice. Okay, so the elephant in the room is, this is the part of the podcast where I want to speak about what's going on right now. And yesterday there was, or not even yesterday, this week, there was a CEO that's written on LinkedIn that he had let go of two members of his staff. And if you scroll down, you would have seen a photo of him crying and being very sad and upset. The thing went viral. Everyone is like, how dare this CEO do this? Like, how can he be asking for compassion and sympathy if he's just let somebody go? Why is he taking this to LinkedIn? Is he a narcissist? Then you've got the employees coming back being like, whoa, defending him. It's kicked off, right? Like everything does on LinkedIn or any social media platform. The essence of the conversation that I want to focus around isn't slamming this guy. He's a guy, he's done a thing, it's gone viral. What it has done is bring into question the how much are we forcing users of these social media platforms to overshare? And should we all be oversharing to the point where you get crippling abuse from strangers on different platforms that you might not even be on?
Yeah.
And what do we think? So Carol, I'm going to start with you. You're on LinkedIn.
Yeah.
How do you feel about this whole oversharing thing and vulnerability porn, as we're going to call it?
Yeah. Is he oversharing? You said oversharing. I didn't say oversharing.
That's a good question. Is he oversharing?
I guess you'd say, is he oversharing? Then also you kind of ask yourself, well, I'm asking myself because you've just asked me the question now, but I'm thinking to myself, well, you know, there is a lot of talk at the moment about vulnerability and leadership. But is this the right space that he's, you know, doing that in it? And is he, I think if I remember rightly when I saw it, he actually says, this is the most vulnerable I'm going to be. You know, is that vulnerability? You know, is taking a picture of yourself crying being vulnerable? Is that vulnerable? I don't know. And I kind of go, part of me asks the question, well, did you ask the people that you fired? Did you tell them that this is what you were going to do? And also, what was the intent? What did he think would happen? What did he want to happen? Why did he put that out? What was the intent? Because I kind of don't understand what that would be. And if he was being really vulnerable, if he really cared about his staff, did he think that that action would help them in any way?
I think that's a really good point, the intent thing. Because you look at Instagram, right? Yeah. The last 10 years of Instagram is, why have you put that picture up? What did you want out of that? And usually it's likes and it's validation that you look good. The same thing is happening to LinkedIn. People have spotted that the algorithm works in your favor. If you talk about a sad story and how you've been affected by it, you get comments, that drives more traffic, more people see it, you become a LinkedIn influencer, right? So people are clocking that and they're going, right. So when you are sharing this vulnerable stuff and, you know, you in a weaker place and not just going, I'm a leader and I'm very successful, are you sharing that to gain more of an audience in a bit of a crass way? I think for me, that's what I'm picking up where the frustration is coming from. Is people are going, you've got all of this publicity because you have shared a weakness where, to be honest, I'm kind of I'm questioning how hard that was for you. And actually, I'm questioning what you wanted out of posting that thing. I'm sitting as Switzerland on this, right? Because I don't believe this guy should be lambasted and shouted at and taken to shreds on social media. But I definitely have to agree with you in questioning the intent behind not just his post, but every post from everyone on LinkedIn. Yeah. What did you want out of it? Because you've got it. you've built the fire. You poured the petrol on. You've got to stand here and get the warmth from the flames. You can't just let that out. And you go, oh, I didn't mean to. Because you did. You did it for a reason. So I want to ask Sam. Sorry, Sam. I'm going on a rant here. And
Sam, how would you feel if you've been laid off by Ollie and he just did that post?
Shall I ask Sam directly so that gets picked up? How would you feel if you saw me, if I let you go, right, and you've gone, fucking hell, I've lost my job, and you walk home, and next morning you see a photo of me going, I'm being really vulnerable here, I fired two people yesterday. How would you feel?
I think it's the initial reaction, if there was just like 10 likes, I'd be like, is he just doing this for attention? or I would have to see the full post, I think, because there was, that guy wrote a lot. And I think there's probably some good intention behind it in raising awareness for mental health and vulnerability and things like that. It's a good question. Knowing you so well, I don't know how I would react to it because it's a bit out of character.
Great answer. He's not getting fired today.
I'll try and articulate it. I think if there's a good motive behind it to help other people, how do I articulate this? If there's a good motive behind it, and you're putting it out to be like, look, if you're a founder or you're a manager and you've had to let somebody go, which is out of your control, I know how you feel. It's okay to feel like this. Mm. I would understand. If you've got 10,000 likes and a load of hate and abuse, and you've got other people taking a mick out of you on other posts, I'd probably be like, look, I know Ollie, he's a really nice guy. This was completely out of his control. So unless it wasn't out of your control, I think anybody would be a bit better.
I just can't, I haven't really sort of, I think when I was about, this is going to sound terribly cruel, but when I was young, if I cried, I might go and have a look at myself in the mirror and go, oh, look at me, I'm crying. But I just don't see how anybody would cry and then take a picture of themselves.
No, it's a and again,
go, I'm going to put this on. I just don't know.
Again, that's why I'd be like, dude, do you want to have a chat? Like, I couldn't.
Yeah, I don't. That is baffling to me. Is the action of going,
oh, I think I'm going to use it. You know what I mean? I just don't know.
Yeah,
I mean,
bizarre.
I really get what he was saying, but I don't know if it needed a picture.
Yeah, I'm with you. Okay.
That's an interesting point. Again, like pictures on LinkedIn. Like we've spoken about it a lot. It's hard because I've got a unconscious bias towards you, knowing what you're like as a manager. So that would be really, it's really, really hard to answer that.
Fair enough. I like that. We've got 7 minutes, and I want to go on to the last topic, which is tremendously exciting. Ian laid this one out for us.
The big question.
The big Q. Carol, obviously you are a guru of knowledge, and you know everything about media platforms and expenditure and subscription values. No, right. We'll cut the bullshit. Netflix. Everyone's saying they're dying, right? You've got Disney Plus, Paramount, teaming up with fucking Five, whatever they're called, Channel Five. Everyone's turning into a streaming platform. Netflix at one point were the monopoly, right? The only place you could go to have a plethora of everything you've ever wanted in one place. And now you go on it and you scroll like a zombie and you go, what the fuck am I going to watch? What's below deck? And you've got Amazon Prime emailing you saying, have you seen the new Ryan Gosling film? And you've got all the... What is going on? Are they going to die? And how do you consume films these days?
Interesting. I am actually on Netflix at the moment. I'm watching things on Netflix. So I guess, but I don't really care about where I'm watching it. I just care about the film.
Right. But how do you get to the film?
It doesn't really matter where I watch. I mean, I am Amazon Prime as well.
Okay.
So on Netflix. I think if Netflix thought that nothing was going to happen and they were still going to always have that, then I think they're foolish to have thought that nobody else would kind of come in and challenge them. I think they needed to be challenged, and they probably need to change it up a bit, don't they?
Yeah.
And I agree with you. You go on it now and you go, you know, it's just literally like, oh, it's a bit like being in a, dare I say, because I'm very old, video shop.
Yeah.
But I just think that's what it feels like. And I think, yes, they do need to do something new. And whether I know whether it's going to, you know, whether it's over or not, I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, because I could have said that about Airbnb.
That's true.
I just saw something different when I walked down the street. I just saw some ads now, which I thought quite cool. Yeah. With what they were doing.
Sam, what about you? How about your consumerism with films?
It's a lot of Netflix. I'm well into Stranger Things at the moment, so I'm on it constantly. It's quite a binge culture at the moment. If you're into a TV show or series and it's on Netflix, you go to Netflix. Or I think if you've got Netflix, you likely probably got Disney or Amazon Prime as well, because there's just so much going on at the moment.
But that's a division of attention, whereas before Netflix was the only place you could. And that is why Stranger Things, the Netflix original, was able to be afforded to be made, because they had loads of cash, because they had all the eyes.
I think
viewership.
I agree with what Carol was saying about it wasn't going to last forever. You know, the bigger companies like the Disney and Amazon and whatnot, and they were always going to compete. It was only a matter of time. Because it wasn't at the very start, weren't Netflix really struggling to buy the rights to Marvel films and all of that stuff? So we knew something was going to happen in the future. It wasn't going to last forever.
This is true.
What's interesting is the money, isn't it?
Yeah, you've got to follow the eyes.
The interesting is that you're still willing to pay, but most people still aren't willing to buy themselves a TV license.
Yeah.
But yet they're paying for Netflix, and then once they've got that, they won't let go. It's a bit like Sky, isn't it? Sky will say once they've got you, really. Very hard to kind of give it up. People just have it.
Yeah, what would drive you to cancel your Netflix subscription? Because we're saying, oh, they're going to die. Yeah, there's a load more, but you're right. We just got, it's not $9.99 anymore, it's $69.99
yeah, it's just
different
gone up,
streamers.
Hasn't it? And people just haven't really bothered
Amazon.
To change
no.
it.
Yeah.
Sky, which is basically what Netflix are offering, that was like, what's that, 100 quid a month or whatever? Even if I have like Amazon, Disney, fucking Paramount, all of them, like that's probably only 70 quid and I've got access to pretty much everything. I don't know, what would drive you to cancel one of them? Unless you were quite, you know,
you'd have to be really annoyed about something that they did, wouldn't you? You'd just be thinking you were getting at somebody, and I'd go, right, that's it.
Oh, so that maybe it's a brand thing, right? You suddenly become a little bit of, I don't wear Chanel, I don't watch Netflix.
Yeah, it
is, that's a totally different conversation. It's the brand, isn't it, behind, do you believe in Netflix, do you believe in Disney, do you believe in Amazon.
I can't wait to see some of the state of their purposeful advertising.
I bet a lot of people don't use Amazon because they like don't agree with what they're doing or have done, or
environmentally,
like don't like Jeff Bezos for whatever reason. You know, I'm not going to use Amazon Prime. I bet there are people like that.
Yeah, definitely. I think there will be people who,
you know, be little weird culty team people, like
counterculture vibes.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And then somehow they, I don't know, watch a TV show and for free. Because they've clicked on the dark web or something.
Yeah.
Whereas Sky is very different, isn't it? Because it was a lot more human. So you could have a conversation with a Sky person, couldn't you?
Yes.
And sort of almost kind of like, you know, sort of say, you know, I'll only pay this, or can I have this, or whatever. And you can like,
you could haggle them a little bit, couldn't you?
But there's nobody in Netflix, is there?
Not a soul. It's just a bot that goes, hi, how can I help? And it can't. Yeah. Carol, I want to say thank you so much for joining us as our first guest. This has been an experiment and one that I'm very glad that we did. You can find us at Untalented by Unknown on Spotify. We're also going to have our own TikTok channel by the end of next week based on Ian McKenzie of Milk, which is his creative agency name. Yep, and we're going to have our own Twitter. We're going to have a whole load of things. But Carol Davids, if you want a stalker, you can find her on LinkedIn. Don't go any further than that, otherwise she will take out a super injunction.
Yeah, I won't be crying.
No, she's not going to reply either way.
I won't be crying either.
She won't be crying.
Hopefully.